This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Thank you for your question. The deputy president definitely got to a place where his relationship and the president soured on various issues. And so there was a general feeling within the presidency that he is not, him and President Ruto are not seeing eye to eye on a number of issues. So this is what...
That's Edgar Gituwa, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi on the impeachment of Kenya's deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua. Details coming up. Also, seven people died when a bomb went off outside a police training school in Mogadishu. And the U.S. says Israel must allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza or risk losing U.S. weapons funding. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua has been removed from office after he was impeached in a historic vote in the country's Senate on Thursday night. Gachagua becomes the first deputy president to be removed from office in this way since impeachment was introduced in Kenya's 2010 constitution. How did it come to this? For answers, I talked with Dr. Edgar Gituwa, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi.
Thank you for your question. The deputy president definitely got to a place where his relationship and the president soured on various issues. And so there was a general feeling within the presidency that he is not, him and President Ruto are not seeing eye to eye on a number of issues. So this is what brought about the impeachment. This is what created the impeachment, and this is where now the president pushed and marshaled support so that the deputy president could be removed, because under the constitution, the president cannot fire the deputy directly. He can only come out of office through an impeachment motion. So the president could not fire him because they were elected as a pair as per the constitution. So the only way to remove him was through this kind of process.
You are so familiar with the politics of Kenya. Is this kind of the Ruto-Gachagua fallout unprecedented? Because, you know, if we look back into the history of Kenyan politics, in 2018, former President Uhuru Kenyatta and Ruto, his then deputy, had a bitter public falling out.
No, it is not unprecedented. I don't know what happens with Kenyan politics, where at some point the deputy president is always under attack and always gets into problems. But now the difference here is that President Uhuru did not try to impeach President Ruto when he was his deputy. He allowed him to continue staying in office. This is the first time that a sitting president has actually gone ahead to impeach his deputy, to try and engineer the impeachment of his deputy.
How has the Kenyan public reacted to all this?
The country right now is divided. Of course, it's divided because the huge section where the deputy president comes from, which are people from the central parts of Kenya, the region they call the mountain, are feeling betrayed. They are feeling let down because, remember, they voted for Ruto as a man because they were honoring a promise that President Uhuru had made many years ago. President Uhuru said, I am going to serve 10 years as president, and after I finish, I promise you, Ruto will be your next president. So the people from President Uhuru's ethnic community voted for Ruto on a gentleman's agreement, repaying the promise. And so now there's a general feeling of betrayal. There's a general feeling that the president has not kept his word, that whatever differences he had with his deputy, they could have solved them amicably. They could have sat down and talked over the issues without it having to resort to an impeachment.
And you are so right, Dr. Gichua. Gachagua wields significant influence among the Kikuyu, Kenya's largest tribe, to which the ousted vice president belongs. And that support, in turn, helped Ruto win the national election 2 years ago. So moving forward, what is next?
No, yeah, thank you. That's a very nice question. And I think that is where all of us are stuck and worried, because now it simply means we are going to start seeing political realignment. And I'm sure the president has counted the cost, because he would not want to lose the support of such a vast region. And assuming he has lost that vast region, he has to find out where will he get the votes from to make up for that shortfall, because the Kikuyu community, the Kikuyu vote comprised of not less than 47% of the vote that he got to become president. So he needs to look for 47. He has to fill in that gap of 47% from somewhere else. And that is not going to be easy in Kenyan politics.
That was Edgar Gitua, international relations, security, and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He talked with me from the Kenyan capital. Kenya's President William Ruto moved quickly to name a replacement for Rigathi Gachagua, and today he nominated one of his ministers to become his new deputy president. I asked VOA's Nairobi bureau chief correspondent Mariama Diallo to brief us on the details of the new appointment.
Well, his name was actually floated out there. I don't know if you remember our conversation this week. I think you asked me who were the people that President Ruto was thinking about, and I think Kindiki was one of the names that had come out that people were talking about in the media here in Nairobi. So basically, his full name is Abraham Kithure Kindiki. And he's been President Ruto's interior minister, basically. So he's been in the cabinet the past 2 years. And I think when we talk about him being the interior minister, it's important to think that he was interior minister while there were a lot of stuff happening in this country. And I'm just going to give you two quick examples where he came under fire. For example, during the anti-government protests that was spearheaded by the Gen Zs earlier this year, people talked about police brutality. You had a lot of people who passed away and a lot of people who also were injured. And so he was the interior minister during that time. There's also another big thing that Kenya was part of, which is when Kenya basically decided that they were going to send police forces to Haiti. They did manage to do it at the end, but it took a long time, a lot of back and forth, a lot of criticism, as to why Kenya was needing to send its police to Haiti while there was a lot of turmoil here in Kenya. But that was something at the time he defended and said this was an international obligation, and that, he was handling the local security. Basically, it was not going to be affected. So those are definitely kind of two things to think about because he's been the interior minister.
Exactly. So right now, tell me about the reaction by people to the new nominated interior minister who is supposed to become a deputy president.
Yes, indeed. I think on the street, actually, one person that VOA talked with, talked about the outgoing DP, saying that he was too abrasive. He couldn't tone down his language, and that he seemed divisive, so that he supports the president's nomination of Kindiki. He said he was somebody who's very calm, who is a worker, and he hopes that he will do a good job supporting the president, the cabinet, and the entire Kenyan society. But, other people we spoke to, did not agree with the, completely disagree with the way the process went, the fact that he was being impeached, Mr. Gachagua, while he was at the hospital, for example. They said this was untimely. Other people said that they voted for a ticket. It was Ruto and Gachagua, and that in the middle of their 5-year term, here we are, that one person is no longer part of that ticket. So they also criticized that. So, you have a mix of things about how people feel about this whole process.
That was VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Correspondent Mariama Diallo talking with me from the Kenyan capital. And in the latest from Nairobi, a court has blocked Kenyan President William Ruto's new nominee for the deputy presidency, even though Kenya's National Assembly has approved Interior Minister Kithure Kindiki for the job. Police said seven people died and six others were injured after a suicide bomber detonated an unidentified device at a cafe outside a police training school in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. Police say the victims included officers and civilians who were having tea outside the General Kayi Police Academy on Thursday. A paramedic at Medina Hospital said several injured people were receiving treatment. The Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack, though a statement published on its affiliate website. The attack came 2 months after 37 people were killed on a public beach in Mogadishu. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says killing Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar makes clear why his government insisted on continuing the war. Still, Netanyahu warned that the war is not yet over and continues to extract a heavy toll. The Biden administration has warned Israel it must increase the amount of humanitarian aid it is allowing into Gaza within the next 30 days, or it could risk losing access to U.S. weapons funding. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin warned their Israeli counterparts in a letter dated Sunday that the changes must occur. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said a similar letter Blinken sent to Israeli officials in April led to more humanitarian assistance getting to the Palestinian territory. But that has not lasted. Hadar Saskind, president of Americans for Peace Now, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi the need for the U.S. to do more.
First of all, we issued a statement when we saw this letter saying that, you know, while we appreciate the letter, we appreciate the sentiment and the fact that the Biden administration is urging the Israeli government to allow aid in, that it frankly is simply not enough. It's not sufficient. There have been previous communications like this in April and otherwise, and we've seen brief increases in aid, including following this letter on Sunday. In the last few days, more trucks have gone into Gaza bearing aid. But again, it's not enough. And it hasn't been consistent. So we believe that the U.S. government should follow its own laws, much less international law, frankly, and demand that the Israelis allow sufficient aid in. That's food, that's water, that's medicine, that's fuel, all of the things that the people of Gaza need for survival purposes. And ultimately, that's a decision of the Israeli government, not the U.S. government. But if the Israeli government is not doing that, then they are in violation of both U.S. and international law. And the United States should follow our own laws, which means no longer supplying offensive weapons to the Israelis, if that is the case.
Humanitarian aid groups fear that Israeli leaders may approve a plan to seal off humanitarian aid to northern Gaza in an attempt to starve out Hamas, which could trap hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who are unwilling or unable to leave their homes without food, water, medicine, and fuel. Would Israel use starvation as a weapon in Gaza?
Well, the plan that many groups and others are responding to, it's important to note, was a plan put out by retired military officials. Neither the government nor the military has endorsed the plan, and they've both said that they do not endorse the plan. That being said, there's no question, it's not a hypothetical. There is rampant hunger in Gaza, and Israel is not allowing sufficient aid in. The important part isn't whether they're following some plan that was proposed or not. It's the reality of what's happening on the ground. And that reality is famine. That reality is widespread hunger. And it doesn't matter whether the government of Israel says they're using it as a weapon of war or not. Those people are hungry. And so they need to change their policy. and allow more food in and allow more aid in.
The United States has spent a record of at least $17.9 billion on military aid to Israel since the war in Gaza began. That aid has enabled Israel to purchase billions of dollars worth of munitions it has used in its operations against Hamas in Gaza and then Hezbollah in Lebanon. However, many of those strikes also have killed civilians in both areas. How does Americans for Peace Now see a balance between defending Israel and protecting civilian lives?
It's obviously, this whole year has been a horrible and very difficult situation. It's been horrible for Israel and Israelis. It's been horrible for Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, now for Lebanese. This year has seen so much death and so much destruction. So what we hope for is an end to that, an end to this war, an end to the violence, an end to the conflict, and hopefully a better future for Israeli and Palestinian people alike. Right now, in the short term, before we get to that, you know, we need to acknowledge that Israel has very legitimate security needs. They were viciously attacked on October 7th by Hamas. Iran has twice now fired hundreds and hundreds of missiles. I mean, thousands of missiles have rained down from Hezbollah in the north. So there are very real, very serious security concerns that Israel has, and that the U.S. supports Israel in defending itself. The challenging part is drawing that line between what is that legitimate and important defense and saying responding to horrible attacks doesn't mean that you can do anything. It doesn't mean that what we have seen in Gaza is okay, because it is not. And the United States government has been clear that it doesn't support that. It doesn't want to see further strikes on civilians. And likewise in Lebanon now as this develops. But the problem has been that the action has not followed up the rhetoric on the part of the U.S. government. So we have long called for the United States to condition its aid to Israel, which does not mean ending aid, but it means making sure that our aid is used only in support of our policies and our values. And that if that's not the case, then we have consequences that go with that.
That was Hadar Saskin, the president of Americans for Peace Now, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. EU leaders called Thursday for urgent new legislation to increase and speed up migrant returns after a Brussels summit that crystallized a rightward shift in the bloc's rhetoric. The 27 European leaders said their day-long talks saw in-depth discussions on migration, an issue that has shot up the political agenda following hard right gains in several countries. According to the French news agency AFP, delegates called for determined action at all levels to facilitate, increase, and speed up returns from the European Union. Analysts say that means the potential consideration of return centers outside the European Union, which did not get an outright mention. Divisions remain on the next steps, with no concrete plans laid out in the final text. Disagreements caused the previous effort to overhaul migrant return rules to fail in 2018. The U.S. state of Florida, North Carolina, and Georgia are dealing with the aftermath of two major hurricanes that killed hundreds of people and caused tens of billions of dollars in damage. With the presidential election less than a month away and the race extremely close, White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wirakuswara looks at how the storms might impact voting in these states.
States hit hard by Hurricane Helene in late September and Milton earlier this month are trying to return to normal, with power restored to most areas and ongoing debris removal. President Joe Biden visited impacted areas in Florida earlier this week, encouraging people to come together.
Not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans. Americans who need help, and Americans who help you if you were in the same situation.
It's hard to separate storm response from the politics that surrounds it. Studies show that voters reward the incumbent's party when the federal government comes through with disaster relief and punish them when it doesn't. Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris has been highlighting the Biden administration's efforts.
I have spoken with state, local officials, both Republican and Democrat, to let them know we will be with you every step of the way as you recover and rebuild.
While her Republican rival Donald Trump has spread misinformation about the federal government's response, claiming that it has avoided Republican areas and it used up relief funding to help illegal immigrants.
The federal government, on the other hand, has not done what you're supposed to be doing, in particular with respect to North Carolina. They've let those people suffer unjustly.
The Atlantic hurricane season peaks in the months right before the November election. For decades, officials have built disaster contingencies into their election planning, but now they must also deal with disinformation. Kim Wyman, senior fellow with Bipartisan Policy Center's Elections Project via Zoom.
Well, I think that's the biggest challenge that election officials in particular are facing right now in the aftermath of these hurricanes, because we are seeing on social media people making wild claims about, the ability for voters to cast a ballot, the impact that the hurricanes had on the election, and that voting will not take place now because of it. And so we really encourage voters to go to trusted sources.
Politics aside, with some roads.
That was White House Bureau Chief Patsy with Kuswara. Now, I have in studio with me VOA sports analyst intern Omolemo Kale, and he is here to fill us women's cricket, T20, World Cup results, and which events to look forward to watching this weekend. Welcome to African News Tonight, Omolemo.
Thank you so much.
So fill us in on who is in the women's T20 World Cup final.
Yes, so South Africa will be in the finals tomorrow, and they will be facing off against either the two West Indies or New Zealand, playing today for the semifinals.
Anything else exciting happening, like news or drama happening recently?
Yes, well, Paul Pogba, in a recent interview, had got the chance to speak about his recent doping ban that got reduced from 4 years to 18 months. And so now he will be looking forward to playing in the World Cup in 2026.
So how about this weekend? Any events you think we should look out for?
Yes, yes. So the Six Kings Slam tennis tournament is now coming to an end in this weekend in the final. Yannick Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz will be playing, and the winner out of the two will be winning a grand prize of $6 million.
That was our intern, Omolemo Kale, VOA sports analyst. Thank you for your input. And before we even close, I have one more news to deliver, and that is South Africa's government said today it has asked Taiwan to relocate its de facto embassy out of the capital, Pretoria, while Taiwan accused it of bowing to pressure from China. South Africa rejected this characterization and said the move was standard diplomatic practice, given that it severed political and diplomatic ties with Taiwan in 1997. Reuters reports that the Taipei Liaison Office in Pretoria will be rebranded as a trade office and moved to commercial capital Johannesburg. China is South Africa's largest trading partner globally and one with which it is looking to expand cooperation in areas such as renewable energy.
VOA. VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.